He's passionate. Partisan? Proper. He's relentless. Renowned. Respected. A one-off. The boss. The only person you want to hear at kickoff. He's Birmingham's Tom Ross. Hi, this is Jasper Carrot. For generations, Tom Ross has been the undisputed voice of sport in the Midlands.
Unbelievable.
He's given us listeners years of heart-stopping moments.
Darren Carter, with this kick, could put Birmingham City into the Premiership. Come on, Darren!
Always there, he's been our shoulder to cry.
Would I get the hour at the club, Tom? There's nothing for me at that club, Tom. Nothing can alter our man.
And he's had his own fair share of low points too.
I just broke down. I just couldn't control it.
He's done his bit for the community and local charities and even released a pop song or two.
I must be the oldest person ever. Centre page magic. Brilliant.
But most of all, he's given us memories that will last a lifetime.
It goes into Zigic. It's hooked. Oh!
Today marks the 35th anniversary of Tom broadcasting on this famous frequency.
Wow.
Wow. And for once, we're turning the tables. For the next hour, it's him answering all the questions.
Listen to this.
This is 35 years of Tom Ross.
35 years, yeah, 35 years. Who'd have thought it? I certainly wouldn't the day I walked in anyway, that's for sure. I'd been at the BBC and I had a call from Tony Butler.
021-359-4011. He'll get you to me.
Hello, my boy. I want to see you at the D Club. Okay, that's at Birmingham City, where he used to go for the odd pint with Alan Inston and in the D Club at lunchtimes. So I went to see him. That was really the interview, really, at the time, because he didn't say, so would you like to? He went, you're going to Stoke Saturday? That was it. So I went to Stoke Birmingham Saturday. And to be fair with you, I thought I'd done a really good job. It was 0-0, 28th of March, 1981. And the next day, I was playing for the BRMB, as it was then, football team at Tally Ho. We'd got a charity match. Walked into the dressing room, chest puffed out, and he looked at me, Butler, all the others in the dressing room as well, and he went, if that's the best you can do, you can sod off back to the BBC. No HR in them days.
Get your prayer mats, Andy. Down on your knees all together now. On your knees. Bite your fingernails.
On reflection, I think Butler was probably trying to test me. If you're doing a report into a game, he said he wanted 20 seconds. Now, that's 20 seconds, whether it's 5-5 or 0-0. You got to 22 seconds, and all of a sudden you'd hear Butler's voice cut across you. It's, oh, that's Tom. They just cut you off. He didn't just do it to callers. He did it to his reporters. You learnt. You didn't have any training. You didn't have any HR to complain to. You learnt on the job. You know, that was my first introduction to BRMB.
Gray chips it over, and it's in! Stuart Gray says, thanks a lot. That's my second. Villa 6, Port Vale 0.
I'd grown up in the inner city slums to start with, you know, and I know that in the modern day, if you haven't got an iPhone 6S, you know, you're poverty stricken. No, I'm talking real genuine poverty. There was a lot of us, Irish, Scottish Catholic family in the inner city at two, the back of 437 New John Street West, just off Summer Lane, between Summer Lane and Newtown Road, which is big villa territory, let me tell you. We lived up the entry, right, up the yard. And as you went into the entry to get down into the courtyard where there was five houses, well, houses, can't call them houses, but nevertheless, Millman's, the one behind the shop was where the Millmans lived. The one on the left, I can remember now, there was there. And then there was the toilets, and then there was a house in the corner, one in the middle, and ours was on the right next to the wall. And you walked in and there was just a room. The stove was in one corner. There was a curtain in that corner and the sink was behind it, steps down to the cellar, and that was it. There was nothing else. There was no porch. That was it. And then you went up the stairs and there was a bedroom. That was Mum and my dad's. And then to the attic where we all were. And it was quite strange, really, because we were all six to a bed. I mean, I read stories in was in the News of the World as was, talking about three in a bed scandal, whew, long before then, six in a bed. And with six of them, you know, you had to make sure you got the shallow end because it could be dangerous. And we had Dad's army coat over us. I mean, it was tough times. But none of my mates had anything that I went to school with. None of my mates, none of your pals. So there weren't the peer pressure that kids get today. All my mates had holes in the pumps because they wore pumps guns, because they didn't wear shoes. Not till later on. But in those really early austere days, and I'm telling you, it was dreadful. You know, you never knew where the next food. There was no dole money given to you. And if my mum and dad were out of work, that was it. You were struggling. But my mum was a staunch Catholic and wouldn't let us, you know, if you didn't earn it, you didn't have it, you didn't eat. But my old man was brilliant. He could get six penneth of chips and we'd all be well fed on it. Or he could get a Swiss roll on a Sunday when times were good and get 200 slices out of a Swiss roll. But if you hold one up, you could see through it. It was amazing. It was brilliant, my dad. I loved him to death. There was no electricity. It was gas mantles. Then they put electricity downstairs only, but not upstairs. And the things I did, hanging out the attic window, by my fingertips. I mean, health and safety would never fit now, the things we used to get up to. But then, you know, as I got a bit older, I got in with a bad crowd when I was 14. But no, I was as bad as them. I shouldn't say a bad crowd. I was as bad as them, but I was influenced. And I remember once we ran away. We ran away to Sutton, where I now live. Then days, the Bobbies were always around. All right, what's going on here then? Well, we've run away. Yeah, right. Black Mariah, back to where you come from, Bridge Street West Police Station. So we're all sitting in the cells. They put us in the cells. I think that was just to scare us. Only kids. And I remember my mum and dad coming up because they went down to my address, woke my mum and dad up. My mum just looked at me. I knew I'd got it coming. My mum had that Irish, Belfast Irish girl, man, that look. And I knew I was in for it. And all the way down New John Street West, it was only 800 yards from the police station. And in time, she's whacking me. I told you never to bring trouble to my house. Bang. I told you, bang. All the way down. And my dad's saying nothing all this time. And we get in and then I get it again from her. And she goes to bed. And that's when I think the most epiphany moment in my life was my old man, who never had a car, you know, never owned a car, never owned a house. Tough Glaswegian geezer. And he sat me down and he went, and we never had dad chats. I don't know how to explain it, but in them days, it were never the dad chats. There was never overly signs of love, but everybody loved everybody. We loved each other as a family, but there was no tactile, there wasn't around. So he just sat me down and he just told me straight. He said, live your life by your standards, not anybody else's. That's what he told me. And it registered for whatever reason. And he said, never be ashamed to pick your wages up when you go to work. This was part of the chat. And the third one, he says, and don't let anybody take the And that's been my mantra. That's been my life's mantra ever since. And that's the way I am. And I've told all my kids the same. I've passed that wisdom on. And he never had anything, you know. But he was a really wise man in many ways. It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished him well. I left school in 1964. I decided I'd have a gap weekend. So I finished school on Friday, started work on Monday at Gothic Electrical, where I was going into the accounts department. But I got there and they were short in the buying department. Would I help out for a week? And I was there for a long time. You know, I loved it there, though. I met some great friends. I had a lot of mishaps as well, female-wise, along the way. You know, they used to have concerts and things, and that's probably where I got the performing thing, because me and a guy called John Stott used to get the guitars out and, you know, at these concerts, and we'd do Sonny and Cher stuff and with a bit of comedy and magic thrown in and all that, just to entertain the staff. But I got this bug in me. I wanted to earn money. I had to get married. And I wanted to earn some money, so sales was the obvious thing for me, because I had the gift of the gab anyway. And so I was offered a job at City Electrical Factors, and I went there. And I wasn't there that long before they asked me to go and open their Scottish operation, because they were known all over England, but not in Scotland. Still going today, massive. But my wife at the time, Maureen, didn't want to move up close to her family and stuff. I was coming down to play football every weekend. In the end, I came back and was poached by a company called Superlamp Metallic, and very quickly there, from Birmingham branch manager, I became one of their four regional managers looking after the Midlands and the North East, and I loved it. But I had a fallout when they asked me to do something that I didn't believe was strictly legal. And I told them so. Well, I always wanted to run my own business. So my pal then, Bob Ravenhall, and I decided we were going to go our own way and start our own. And we did, with the girl called Janice Jennings, who was Bert Eel's daughter. We got thriving with a multi-million pound business. But then her dad, when the building industry collapsed, he went bust and it put us under. So Bob and I carried on working for a long time without any money to pay off all the creditors. So we'd done that. But I decided that business was enough for me. I'd had enough. And so I went to work for one of the largest companies in the world, Dun & Bradstreet. They do sort of like credit ratings, and it's a massive company worldwide. You only have to Google them to find out. And I was Birmingham branch manager. I was branch manager of the year the first year I was there, which was quite interesting. I won a holiday, I think, or something. And then I was appointed national sales manager. They wanted me to move to London, but I wouldn't. So I got the 6:18 every morning from New Street. They paid first class, to be fair, but I travelled down from New Street every morning and got back at 9 at night. You know, and I loved it, to be fair, but the radio bug was getting to me. I wanted to, and I started to work at hospital radio. And pals of mine like Jasper Carrot did stuff for me there. And I really got that behind the microphone bug. But I was earning a lot of money. In those days, I was earning fortunes. Big company car, national sales manager based in London, no £200 million business, not a problem. So I decided, you know, I was going to have a go at it. So I was at hospital radio. And then the chance came to do a bit for the BBC. And then all of a sudden, the opportunity to go to BRMB.
Goal action.
At Villa Park.
First on BRMB.
Here's Tom Ross.
52 minutes gone. It's Villa 3, Port Vale 0.
I came into radio probably about 29 at the BBC. But here, I was 34. And that's late. Because I was taking a 66% drop in salary. Losing my company car. Losing all the expenses and everything that went with it, and a great career where I could have gone on and done even better. But oh, I had this radio bug.
Mr. Blue Sky, please tell us why you had to head away for so long. Why did we go wrong?
Well, I first had to go in the newsroom. I can see Brian Shepherd now turning round. I can see it. We had this big desk where he worked. That was the news reader's desk. And so we'd have these things there. So we'd take over and put stuff on with a cart, and we'd type out on a typewriter, we'd type out the story and give it him. I can see him now turning and going, Ross, is English your native language? I can hear him. But we had typewriters then, you know, and Tippex, which I used a lot. And very often the ribbon would fray and you got it. And then on the third floor we were, and the last minute before a bulletin, we'd run up the stairs to read. And you'd be in the news booth going, you couldn't hardly speak. The times with Corbs trying to do that, run up the stairs.
Independent local radio for the West Midlands on 261 metres medium wave, that's 1152 kilohertz, and 94.8 VHF in stereo. The news follows in a few moments.
I remember Howard Bennett, who's Brian's assistant, saying to me, listen, we want you to go and cover Prince Charles' visit. And it's down at the Tram Museum opposite Villa Park. I went, you love that. My job was to commentate on what I saw. And so I did all that and I came back and I thought I'd done a really good job. I was chuffed. A few days later, Howard Bennett went, we've had a letter from Buckingham Palace or Kensington Palace congratulating on a wonderful job. And I've gone, wow, I'm chuffed at it. It wasn't until miles after that I realised they'd got the letterhead in and typed it themselves to wind me up. But they got the sack, though.
On your bike, get out!
Shocks, I can tell you, the day it happened, massive shock.
Well, you can relax with a bottle of champagne now. Or maybe it's a cup of coffee or a cup of Bovril. Please yourself, I don't care a damn.
Anyway, they wouldn't take Butler back. George was going to be appointed. I got on great with George Gavin at the time. And he was going to be appointed head of sport. We had a few ups and downs about that because they were going to bring in John Inverdale at one time, and suddenly George found out. The company backtracked and cancelled that deal, and George got it. George involved me in the phone-in first. I was his foil on the phone-in. And that used to get him mad because Blues fans would ring up trying to wind him up because they thought he was Villa. So they'd ring up saying, can I speak to Tom? And he'd go, no. And they'd ask him leading questions and he'd go, I know what you're trying to do, because they were winding him up.
One sane bloke on that programme and it's Tom Ross, not you.
You're a spiteful woman, Jean. You should be ashamed of yourself.
The chemistry worked. Me and him having a go at each other, and wasn't all show, by the way. We did fundamentally disagree about a lot of things.
But you know as well as I do.
Don't ever tell me I know as well as you do.
But it was Radio Gold. It worked.
There's always a danger after a long run that you begin to believe you'll never get beat.
Stupid. Have you ever played football? Have you never ever played and appreciated football?
Can I finish, please, just for a minute?
How can you possibly say they will appreciate losing a match?
Can I just tell you?
Stupid.
Can I just finish off what I was saying?
Yes, you can.
We used to go out and about doing sports forums. I was the gun mic. You know, I'd just go around questions, putting a mic in front of somebody who'd got a question. But, you know, sometimes if they hadn't got a question, you know, it was my job to give them a question to get them to ask so that he got the thing moving. Especially on some of the ones when we did Crown Green Bowls and there was five people in the audience. Oh, dear. Happy days. We had one at, I think it was the Red Lion, I think it was the Red Lion in King's Heath. And Jack Charlton was the guest. And Jack Charlton and Georgia on the stage. They were live then. And all of a sudden, the Animal Liberation Front break in through the door and start giving all that, you, because he was a hunter, of course, Jack Charlton. He loved shooting and like, you're nothing but a killer. And George is sitting on his chair shouting, get them out, get them. Oh, that's all right for you up there, get them out. It's only me and Jimmy Franks. Anyway, these guys start throwing punches at us. Well, what can you do? So me and Jimmy are throwing a few back. In the end, we got them out. But it was mayhem. And I'll never forget that as long as I live. I was also, I did the intro. I did 10-minute comedy slot before we started to warm the audience up. And then I went and produced it.
Friday, and that means live from the Covington Social Club, it's the Celebrity Sports Forum.
And George was a great operator at them. George Gavin was a great. We didn't always get on, you know, and I don't really want to go into that here, but we didn't always get on. For a number of reasons, and suffice to say, from the minute he left, and I haven't spoke to him. So, but nevertheless, that doesn't detract from how good an operator he was for BRMB as was then.
Team will win.
Gareth. Radio City is 051-226-4741. They have a phone-in program on Saturday at 1 o'clock. Give them a call. Don't bother me again. Thank you very much.
In 92-93. Capital Radio bought the BRMB group and Richard Park came up. I thought I was going to get the sack the first day he walked in because he had me and George in the office with Ian Rufus, it was at the time, our MD, and said, I'm going to, in his broad Scottish accent, he's well known in radio, I'm going to meet this Aston Villa FM. I said, oh, right. I said, you're mad. I could see the look on the others' faces. I said, you crackers. I said, this town's got more than one team. I really thought I'd killed my career before he'd started. But no, it was fantastic. And he checked and he agreed. And we weren't Villa FM. And George didn't hang around long. He went to Radio 5. And I'll never forget the day Parky came in. He went, I think we should go for a drink. Now, that could either mean two things with him. You're getting a red card or something good. Anyway, something good. He offered me the job as head of sport, which was absolutely fantastic. It was the greatest day I can think of in my life. I was dancing all the way back. It was fantastic. But he let me do it my way, and I made that clear.
So much for your time wasting, you chirpy cockney cheat!
I embarked then on a journey as group head of sport, but what I didn't want to do was be the second Tony Butler or George Gavin. I didn't, and I was determined not to be. I wanted to be me, and I made changes. Changes the way we did it, changes to the way we did the commentary, changes that I thought were right. I remember one time, Villa were playing Manchester United, and my philosophy is the away games get you a bigger audience. They always have, always will. But the philosophy that came with London, which Jonathan Pearce's philosophy in Capital in London, was do the big game. And if Man United are in town, you do it. You know, sod the rest of the teams, you're doing that game. Well, that's okay, making you feel good, but is it what the audience wants? You know, Villa Park would have 42,000 in then for Man U. So your massive audience for a Birmingham or West Brom away game was where I was looking. But I was persuaded. I went against my principles and I did the Man U game. Well, there were 3-1 up, 10 minutes to go, Blues were 0-0, so I swapped the games. On Monday morning, call from Richard Park. You changed the game? I said, yes. I said, and I told him why. Explain why. He went, if you believe that, then the lunatics are running the asylum. That's what he said to me. I'll never forget it. And I argued the case, and he went, can I ask you, are you handing in your badge? So anyway, somebody had obviously told him what we'd done, what I'd done, and that worried me. So it ended up with me having Richard telling him I wanted to see him. I went down, I told him I can't work under these things. You allow me to do it my way, and I guarantee you an audience, the best in the business. I guarantee you'll be number one in Birmingham if you let me have my head. And that was when he said, weird phrase, but he went, listen, I don't care what they say, you're part of Park's posse. Go and do it. And remember, you know, you're going to get me the best audience. And I did. It was all I ever wanted to do. In my own town, BRMB, my own town, my station, I just couldn't believe it. And a football nutcase gets the chance to run the sport. We had the biggest audience this station's ever had. And that's what I promised Richard, and that's what I delivered. But I've had some fun along the way. On sport, doing massive games. In 1992, Blues reached the final of the Leyland DAF. Lou Macari allowed me to travel with the team. They allowed me to stay at the team's hotel and do phone-ins from there. Weird story, this, but it's true. As I stand here, and Nigel Gleghorn and people like that can confirm it. We got on the bus to go training from the hotel. So I get on the bus. Where are we going training? Lou went, don't know. We'll try and find a field. This was a big football club. And we're looking around for a field to train on. And they did. We jumped over a fence and trained. Couldn't believe it. Next day, where we're training, same thing, which was the day before Wembley. Well, what are we going to do? Well, there's one. Found this running track. The gates were locked, so we climbed over. Birmingham City. And Lou went to the lads. He went, I'm not doing it today, lads. Tom's taking the training. And I took the training on the last day before Wembley. And Nigel Gleghorn and John Gill went, well, if he's taking it, we ain't doing it. And I said, you are, or you'll do 20 press-ups. So I had him. The lads were laughing. But think about this. Lou Macari knew exactly what he was doing. A lot of young lads, never, ever played at Wembley, have been anywhere close to it. He got them relaxed, didn't he? Having a laugh with me doing it. And he relaxed them. When they went to extra time and they won the Leyland DAF, I'm taking credit because I trained them on the last day. That's what I say. But they allowed me to sit on the bench. Gary Newbon tells everybody he was the first. No, you weren't, Gary. I did it for the Leyland DAF final. I sat on and broadcast from the bench next to the subs. It was amazing. I had to come in my tracksuit with a bucket with my headphones in. But I couldn't contain myself. When they won it, I went, oh, sod it. I did a lap of honour with the team carrying the trophy. Goal Zone. Football's been great to me in terms of travelling. I've travelled all over the place to see football matches. The fun I had going to Walsall under Ken, when Ken Weldon was in charge, going to West Brom when Alan Buckley, Smith and Megson were in charge. I had great times. Wolverhampton Wanderers, my first job with Butler was sending me all over the blooming place with them and their team. And I'll never forget that crazy Wolves army as they came back from the fourth division scoring goals with Bully and Much. And I was at most of their away games. It was amazing. And even recently went to Slovenia, we went to Bruges with Birmingham in the Europa League, went to Milan with Villa. Went to Czechoslovakia, been lots of places. And we came out of the station and we're walking up and this girl's opposite, stunning girl, shouted us. And she opened her fur coat and she was naked underneath. And it'd be rude not to just have a chat with her. And all of a sudden she opened her other coat and let me tell you, we found out it was Arthur, not Martha. So we've done a runner. I'm telling you, We have been quicker than Usain Bolt. We have gone. The playoff final was amazing against Norwich. I mean, I was nervous. And you always think as a Blues fan, no, it's not going to happen. This won't happen. And it went to extra time and then penalties.
Granger takes a kick, gives it to Kenner. Kenner puts it into the box. Stern John wins the header down. There's a goal! Yeah! A horse has hit home! Jeff Horsfield in the year of the horse has equalised for Blues! Jeff Horsfield has put it into the back of the net for Blues! And in the year of the horse, he can have his oats as often as he likes! Blues 1, Norwich 1!
And you thought, nah, we'll still get the kick in the you-know-whats. Anyway, it ends up with one penalty to go. The last penalty. Darren Carter. He's 17. And I've gone, oh, no. This ain't gonna work.
Darren Carter, with this kick, could put Birmingham City into the Premiership. Come on, Darren. Come on! He puts the ball on the spot. The young teenager, the England under 19 international, puts the ball on the spot. Come on, Darren. Come on, Darren. Come on. Here he comes. He does. Yes!
Yes! Yes! We're in the Premiership, Rossi! We're back! Yes!
The Blues fans are celebrating. It's absolutely pandemonium. They're on the pitch. They're on the pitch. But Birmingham City are in the Premiership with West Bromwich Albion and Aston Villa. Birmingham City are in the Premiership.
We just lost it, and from that moment it was just an amazing, amazing... I can remember the phone in. People ringing from home, wives and mothers whose families were at the game, who were emotional with us. And Darren Carter, live on the pitch, talking to us. And he missed the team photo because he was talking to us. He's never forgiven me for that. This was a young lad that, you know, at times had been sleeping on my settee at home because he was a friend of my lad's, along with Capaldi and Peter Gilbert and people like that. He'd been sleeping on my blooming settee, and there he is scoring the goal that gets Blues promoted. And when he was eight, I presented him with his award, his medal at Alton Ravens, his football club. So there was quite a connection there. For that lad to score, for a Brummie lad, Blue Nose, to score was amazing. And I'll never, I mean, I can't tell you how, I'll never forget that. It was just totally, totally amazing. The Carling Cup final was an amazing journey. The quarterfinal beating Aston Villa, the semi-final coming from 3-1 down to beat West Ham, to get to the four, was just truly, truly amazing.
Car breaks down the right-hand side, chance for Blues.
Gardner's inside,
plays it to Gardner. It opens up for Gardner. Can he strike this one? Yes, he can. Yes! 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 Gardner rattles it in. Blues take the lead. And the sound you can hear are bubbles popping all over the Midlands. They're popping like crazy. It's Blues 3, West Ham 1, 4-3 on aggregate.
That day at Wembley, there's a blur. It's like getting married, it's a blur. Touchline goes Adam Bridge. So I said, let's cross to Adam Bridge, who's with the crowd, the Blues fans. And he goes, I've got Bill with me here, Tom. Right. Bill, what about today? And this guy went, well, I've come with me, mate. And Adam went, well, where's your mate then? He went, he's here. And he had an urn. He'd promised his mate who died that if Blues got to Wembley, he'd take him, and he brought him. That bent me well up. I thought that was amazing.
That's it, I got a special bag, Tom.
Well, it's in my bag. It's my best friend's ashes. He died 10 years ago. He'd love to be here today, and he's come with me today. He'd be sitting on my lap all game, mate.
And then he went along to a young lad. He went, Jordan, what a big day. Yeah, I love it. Fabulous. You'd love to play on that pitch, wouldn't you? And the lad went, I did yesterday for the English schools, eh, mate?
I can't tell you, this is what it's all about. They're there and they want to wish all the Blues players to have the game of their lives for a win, 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 win.
And I'll never forget the winning goal going in and John McCarthy just giggling. Just giggling. He couldn't do anything but giggle.
Listen to this. It goes into Zigic. It's hooked.
Oh! Martins has won the game for Blues in the dying second of normal time. The keeper has cocked it up and he's taken advantage over Femi Martins. Arsenal 1, Blues 2.
One more bit of defending, that's all it is.
One more bit of defending. And it's a long throw into the box. Headed away by Carr. It's headed away brilliantly by Ferguson. It's put back in. Yes! Yes! Birmingham City have won the Carling Cup. They've won their first major trophy in 136 years. And they've made me the happiest man on the planet. I can't believe it. I can't tell you what this means to the City of Brom and to the Blues fans who've had 136 years of hurt. Birmingham City have won the Carling Cup.
And I remember saying, this is better than sex. And all you hear McCarthy go is, it is the way you do it, lad.
This is why it's the greatest game on the planet. This is better than sex.
And I think it might be the way you're doing it, lad.
A few funny sayings over the years, some that were meant to be funny and some that weren't. But one of the things I always said in the early days was, it drives you barmy. I always remember walking down with Adam, Paul Jackson, who was then the programme director, and somebody else, down Broad Street. And this dustbin lorry come past, and they were all shouting, "It drives you barmy." That was all they said. Just nuts. The Game's Gone is one that I've always used. Drives you barmy, you'll do for me. And even now, Jeremy Kyle, whenever he's in town, he'll give me a call and he'll go, 359-5-9, I'll get you to me. He's trying to impersonate me. It was a very good one, actually. Ding Dong Derby. Yeah. I don't know where that came from, because I've been at lots of derbies where there's been a lot of ding and not much dong, to be perfectly honest with you.
There's a chance! 1-0 in the Ding Dong Derby!
I don't start out to have a saying, but it just takes over. Because remember, I did the breakfast show as well for a long time, 10 years or more. And, you know, I called listeners nuggets. Donuts, you donut, you nugget. And we used to give away donuts because of it. Greg's wanted to sponsor us to give away donuts because it was a saying of mine. And nuggets, we had sweets made, capital gold nuggets that we used to give away. And just amazing. But the breakfast show was an amazing time as well. An amazing time.
Now a chance. Well, I think... Well, they're giving me excellent support, the Blues fans.
It makes you feel good that people think you've played a little part in their lives. And even today, I go out and some man will come up and say, "Can my son have a picture with you?" And I go, "Yeah, of course." And then he'll lean down to his 8-year-old son and say, "I used to listen to this man when I was your age, you know?" And you realise then you're getting on a little bit. It don't matter what the boss thinks. The only real judges are the people listening. They're the judges. I'm a fan with a microphone. I'm not above them. I'm not below them. I'm a fan with a microphone. I'm paid to give an opinion. But is my opinion more valid than a listener? No, it isn't.
It's killing me, Tom. I tell you, if you don't want to put no money in, why don't you get the hell out of the club, Tom, for me? He does nothing for me, for that club, Tom. Nothing at all. For our match.
The wonderful thing about it is, wherever I go, the amount of people that come up and say, "God, I spent all my life listening to you." And that makes me feel good, not through a conceited way, but it makes me feel good that they feel it was important for me to be a part of their lives, you know, and that is a great feeling. It's humbling and privilege to be part of people's lives for so long.
You keep us going every single game, and thank you very much to you for the support of Birmingham City Football Club.
Yes, great stuff, Tommy. You are a gem, and it's absolutely brilliant.
Nothing's ever always great. I've had lows, yeah. I remember I got a lump on my leg, and my friend and who's a doctor, Dr. Sangira, said, you've got to go and have that looked at. And he arranged for me to go to the Solihull Private Hospital, the Spire. And I can't remember his name now, but I saw a specialist. And he took a biopsy. In other words, froze my leg, took a bit of the lump out and sent it away. And I had to go back and see him. And I went back and seen him. And I got to say, in terms of bad moments, it's one of the worst. When he looks at you, he said, there's no way of beating around the bush about this. It is cancer and it is malignant. So now you know. I can't tell you how lonely you feel when them words hit you. You do. There's nobody else can help you. It's just what he said. He said, so what we got to do? No ifs and buts, chop it out. That was his words. Chop it out. Yeah, good. He said, we don't know how far it spread, but the operation will tell us. He said, I will tell you now. He said, it's not life-threatening. So that made me feel a lot better. And he arranged for me then to meet a guy called Remo Papini, the surgeon, who's was based at the QE. And he was the man who did all the things for the soldiers who've been in Iraq and badly injured. He was the man that did all the operations on the soldiers that were badly injured. But I said to him, I wasn't going to be knocked out because I'm not having that. And so he gave me this fabulous local anaesthetic they use on soldiers out in the field, apparently. And you don't feel anything, which was great. So I'm at the Spire. I'm taken down to the theatre. And he's got one nurse on either side of me. One's Blues and one's Villa. Well, it didn't take me long to get a row started, did it? And he's trying to do this operation. He's absolutely in hysterics. He had to take a large piece of my skin off my thigh to graft over where he chopped everything out. Then all I can hear is the sound of, like a staple gun. I can't feel anything, but I can hear this. And I said to him, what are you doing? He said, I'm stapling the skin to your leg. Cool, I nearly fainted then. But we had a great time in the theatre. And he said to me, listen, whatever you do, he said, no working. I'm telling you now, put your foot up, because if your foot's up, the graft takes easier because the blood flows better. Your foot, it's got to be higher than your head. I mean, yeah, okay. Yeah, no worries. He said, but whatever you do, he said, don't knock it. You can't knock it. So I get into a wheelchair and the porter immediately smashes me into the door. The bad leg. I hadn't told my family or anything. I just went and had it done. But my son John, I told, and he came with me on the day. And he came and took me home after I'd been in there all day. And they said, all right, you can go home now. But I'd not had a day off ill. And I wasn't going to. So stupidly, and it is stupid, I came into work the next day, gritted my teeth, and walked as if I'd nothing wrong. And I told Adam Bridge, who was our programme director then, what had happened. And he wanted to send me home, but I said, no, I'm doing the phone-in. So I sat doing the phone-in with my foot up. And the following day I was at West Brom, and John Simpson, who was their press officer, arranged a big box and everything so I could have my foot higher than everything else. And I did the game. I did the Albion game. And the other really dark day was I was involved in a fatal road accident, leaving a friend's house, and in the pouring rain, I was driving down and the street lights were the old fashioned ones, and you can't. And all of a sudden, I'm driving down this road, not fast, but I'm driving down this road, and there's somebody in front of me, and I hit him, and I got out. We rang the police, but we didn't need to because they were right behind me. A police car, a woman police officer. She came out and she went, "Listen, don't worry. I've seen everything. You couldn't do anything about it." She said, we saw him in the middle of the road when we came up and we turned round and come back, which led me to lose my temper, saying, well, why didn't you stop and put your blue lights on and get him out the middle of the road? Anyway, they took my phone off me to make sure I had been on my phone, breathalyzed and all the usual things, took me on a statement, and they were going to take the car away to examine the car, and it was brand new, the car, but they also have people come out, then a team who check the road markings to see how fast you were going. Amazing what they can do. And they took the gentleman, Mr. Murphy, they took him to hospital. I couldn't sleep. I desperately didn't want to do the game the next day, and I was trying to get people, but I couldn't get anybody to do it. So 7 o'clock in the morning, the door went. It was PC Crozier. And he came in and he told me that Mr. Murphy had sadly passed away in the night time. And I can't tell you how I felt. It's no words can explain it. And I desperately didn't want to do this game, but there was nobody. So I went to do it. And I had to apologise to the listener in the end, because I was all over the place. And I came back and spoke to the bosses and everything. And anyway, I had a few days later, PC Crozier called around my house again and said, listen, here's your phone back. We've checked it. You weren't on the phone at the time. The computers have shown us that you weren't speeding. You were on the right side of the road. It's a tragic accident. You know, you should be okay, but there'll be a coroner's court. And even when he said that, I didn't feel any better. I really didn't feel any better. A man had lost his life. And it was a really tough time. Because I'd not done anything wrong and that it was an accident, I didn't have to go to the inquest. But I said to PC Crozier, I wanted to go because I wanted to face his family. I'm a dad. I wanted to face his family. And so I went to the... And the coroner was off on holiday, and it was a judge they'd got in, a high court judge. The judge made it clear it wasn't my fault, and he said, but you do want to speak to the family and let the family question you? I said, yes. So that I went up, and the family asked me some questions, and I answered them and told them how sorry I was. The inquest is finished, and it was accidental death. And no blame attached to me. He made that clear. Didn't make me feel any better. And I forget the woman's name now, but the clerk of the court, who was a Breakfast Show listener anyway, had taken me into the room again while everybody went. And I'm sitting there and I'm in bits. And the clerk knocked the door and she said, Mr. Murphy's dad wants to see you. And I went, fine, okay. I said, but I knew what was coming. I thought he's going to come in and punch me. You know, and I'd do the same. Anyway, he came in and he just looked and said, listen, we don't blame you. And he gave me a big hug and I broke down. And I have to say, it's horrible. You know, I just broke down. I just couldn't control it. And that helped me a bit, him saying that. And then he went. But I have flashbacks to this day. And whenever it's raining, I'm ultra cautious when it's raining. But he was in, you know, for whatever reason, he was in the middle of the road. And I don't normally, when I left my pal's house, my friend's house, I normally go right. But this time, I just, for some reason, I went left. If I'd have took the normal route, would never have happened. So, and that was another very dark day. As I say, I've had a lot of major ups and a lot of a great life. But, you know, that family were left without a member. Makes you realise you're not invincible. You're not, you know, there's no power looking after you. You're as susceptible as anyone else. And you just change your outlook on life a little bit. You realise, you know, when these things happen, that nothing's forever. And, you know, you're here today, but you might be gone tomorrow. So you have to live life properly and to the full. And always, and it makes you closer to your own family as well. You're that busy being busy. You might not take enough time to see them and you might think, well, I'll see them next week. But when something like this happens, either the cancer or that, you realise that you've got to keep in touch, and that changed my outlook on that as well. So, yeah, tough times then. But not as tough as it was for Mr. Murphy's family. There's been some bizarre moments too, let me tell you, over the years. Robbie Williams was in Take That, of course, and he went missing. And the whole pop world, the whole world was searching for Robbie Williams. Where is he? Mystery. The other band members, Gary Barlow and Orange and all the others, they were all, didn't know where he is, we don't know, we hope he's okay. And this old nugget found him. I was doing a friendly, I think it was, Blues against Liverpool. And he's just in front of us with Razor Ruddock of Liverpool, who's his pal apparently. So I got to him and I said, excuse me, expecting to be told where to go. I said, do you mind if I have a quick word with you about the game and stuff? And he went, of course not. Went into a corner, sat down. I did an interview with him. You know, and I said to him about the game, Port Vale fan, love football, da-di-da-di-da. And then I said, you know, everybody's been looking for you, Robbie, Take That. And he went, and he talked about the fear he had of, you know, one day maybe being stabbed by an overexcited fan. And it was obviously had got to him, you know. And it was a great, you know, it was real. That was a proper exclusive, let me tell you. I've got this dynamite here, and we sent it to London, and all of a sudden, I went from Tom Ross of BRMB to Capital Radio's Tom Ross. I was on every TV station. I was everywhere with this interview. It was amazing, but the way the Nationals treated it, over sensationalised it, so I had to go into the Press Gazette and put the story straight. Because I didn't want Robbie Williams thinking I'd tucked him up. But then the next thing I know, I'm in the middle of Smash Hits. My daughter, Amy, at the time was chuffed to death. She had it every week, Smash Hits. And I was in the middle of Smash Hits, the whole interview, and that was played out. I must be the oldest person ever. Centre page Smash Hits. Well, we've had our fair share of incidents as well at football games. I remember this one time, we were at Ashton Gate and me and Moons are doing, Blues are winning, which is fantastic. So me and Moons are doing the commentary. To my left was BBC Bristol and the pundit was Scott Murray, who I knew from Villa. He's a great lad. He played for Villa before he played for Bristol. So, and they're tweeting out, sorry for the interference. It's a radio station called BRMB because they could hear us over this. And they were they actually, oh, thanks for the plug. But I didn't, it's just the way I am. I didn't ask to be inside. Anyway, we're doing this. And all of a sudden, this geezer turns around and he goes, you cheating Brummy bees, you cheating, you shouldn't be allowed. How can you say that? You should be a show, you. And he's swearing. So in the end, I said, excuse me. The same thing I said, excuse me, I'm not having that. We've got live on air. We're trying to do our jobs. Please allow us to do our jobs.
They had chances, didn't they?
You're talking about they had chances. Rubbish.
Well,
talking a load of rubbish, mate.
With all due respect, my friend, I'm trying to work, if you wouldn't mind. If you wouldn't mind. Well,
fans.
Fine, no, carry on.
Bring a team down next time. Not a load of dirty cheats.
He starts pointing. Tommy Mooney, I'll never forget. Tommy Mooney went, don't you start pointing at me. And I thought, oh, my days, this is going to go off in a minute.
Thank you very much indeed for that. I do appreciate you. Thank you. No. And thank you for that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much
don't
indeed.
Don't point your finger there, mate.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much indeed. We'll be back after this.
We went to a break. Anyway, the second half was the same. Kept standing up. And eventually, Blues win 2-1. I think it was 2-1. And he's walking off mumbling about you, Brummy, cheating referee and you Brummy cheating, whatever.
Would miss two good chances.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. You shouldn't swear like that. We've got children listening. We don't like words like that on the radio with that sort of language, if you don't mind. No, but you are, because I'm live on the air and there's children listening.
And all I can think of doing was, listen, have a safe journey home. Thanks for the points. Tommy cracked up.
Thank you very much. Have a safe journey home. Thank you very much. And thanks
adios
for the points. Thanks for the 3 points. Lovely. Thank you very much indeed.
Tommy cracked up immediately. But, you know, sometimes you just got to be careful that, you know, you don't get into any trouble.
Oh, there. First, pace. Before that, though, is going to come on James Henry. I hate people with two first names. How can I haven't got two first names, Ramoons, have I? No, Ross is not a first name. Ross is a family name in Scotland. Check it. It's only been used by certain people as a first name, by those that should know better.
I mean, I've been very fortunate with my career. And I've been asked for many years to write the stories down, you know, and tell the story of how this snotty-nosed kid who never went to university got the opportunity to have the best job in the world. And this snotty-nosed kid would be interviewing David Cameron, the Prime Minister, would be sitting having tea in the Lord Mayor's parlour. Would it be on, you know what I mean? And famous people on first name terms with, and all this sort of stuff. This snotty nosed kid from the back slums, inner city slums, sitting in a tin bath on a Sunday night, you know, would end up doing that. And people thought it was a story worth telling. I didn't think it was, but people convinced me it was. So I took the opportunity to eventually to write it all down. It was quite therapeutic and quite cathartic to write the book, to be fair. You know, as I say, there's a lot more. We've barely touched the surface, but along the way got the, as I say, the chance to tell the stories, but also a lot of people that I've known have written some nice words about me as well.
So it's my job to read out some of the nice words people have said about him. Won't take long. This is Jasper Carrot, by the way, if you'd forgotten I was here. David Gold wrote how Tom was always welcome in the Birmingham boardroom and he'll always be welcome in his home. That's David's home, not Tom's home, because Tom obviously is going to be welcome in his own home, isn't he? Because he's got through a few marriages, you know. In fact, he's spent more time at the altar than the Pope. Tom Ross is one of the greatest broadcasters on British commercial radio. So says Richard Park. So, not the best, just one of the best. Tony Butler said, I have never met a man who works as hard as Tom Ross. That was Tony talking at the benefits office. Now, here's a proper legend. Tony Bomber Brown. They did have a great chemistry on air, like the elderly version of Anton Deck. He mentioned their habit of corpsing for no reason on the radio. Fitting word, don't you think? You'll like this one. He is a humble and easygoing person, according to Roberto Di Matteo, who's clearly not spent too much time with him. Gary Rowett reckons he can be quite feisty. That sounds more like the Tom we know and love. The comedian Brendan O'Carroll, surprise he's not narrating this one, said his friendship is valued not just by me, but by my entire family. And indeed, the Brown family too. Plug there for the TV programme. What a pro. For me though, what can I say about Tom Ross? Well, I'm his best friend. Yep, I'm his only friend. And we haven't spoken for 2 or 3 years yet. But don't let me put this crushing disappointment on the end of what is a very, very fitting tribute to a wonderful man.
It's like being dead and going to your own funeral, seeing what people think about you and say about you. It brought a lump to my throat, some of them, if I'm honest. It brought a genuine lump to my throat. You know, John Gregory, Villabos and Roberto Di Matteo, people that have done massive things in the game, took the trouble to write a few words about me, and they weren't just saying things for the sake of it, because if you read what they say, they're genuine about the relationship I had with them. And I think the one that comes through with Alex McLeish, Gary Rowett, and all the managers and people, is trust. Trust. That came through. And I think, you know, I don't care what people think of me. As long as they think he's honest, he's trustworthy, he's got integrity, that'll do for me. If you're straight with me, I'll never let you down. I'll always by your side, always got your back, and always work with you. Wherever I go, wherever I've worked, everybody's always written, you know. And I was never worried whether they liked me. I always worried they respected me and they believed I was honest and they believed I was hardworking and trustworthy. Those are the important things to me. And I never compromised those standards. I'll be honest with you that I've got a lot of regrets in my life, particularly about women, which as a young 18-year-old, I let myself down and my family down, because my mum and dad were, you know, together. I think they must have been married over 60 years. But as regards working hard, Everywhere I've been, they'll say the same thing. God, you don't have graft. I thought, work hard and that will do. Other people might say I had certain abilities. I've never said that. I've just always worked harder than anybody else. You've heard me many times say, even on air, I've said, I'm not the best broadcaster in the world, but I'm more passionate, more committed, show more desire, all those sort of things that I think are vital. They're not, you don't get them when you go to an interview. They want to know if you've got a degree and, you know, have you got this and that and how do you feel about the, you know, the whatever, whatever. For me, you might not have the ability. Show me desire, show me commitment, show me graft, and I'll work with you. I made a promise to my bosses, right? The first day I don't want to come to work, I'm packing it in, and I've never had it. I remember I always wanted two things in life from a youngster. I wanted an E-type Jag and a Rolex watch, right? And I never forget my nan going, people like us don't have cars. That was my nan, because they never had one. Don't have cars, people like us. I was determined to not be that. I didn't want to be like that. I wanted to show that with graft, desire, hard work, you can be anything you want in this world. You don't need a piece of paper saying a degree from this university or that university. If you want anything, you can get it. You can do it if you work hard enough. I've got my Rolex. There it is. There's my Rolex. And I didn't get the E-type because they stopped making them. When I moved into radio, I remember my mum and dad was like, oh, you should have a proper job. You had a proper job. What are you giving up a proper job for? My dad heard me on the radio. He was very proud of that, my dad and my mum. Very proud of me on the radio. But I was always kept in my place. So I'd like them to see that their lad did all right in the end. You know, did okay. They were proud that I was on the radio, but those in the early days, I'd like them to have been around to see me achieve the big awards, and I got the Independent Radio 30 years Gold Award for 30 years service to radio. I'd love to, do you know what I mean? I'd like them to have read the book, what I had to say about them. I'd, you know, love that. Because he was my hero, my dad. I don't, you know, it might sound trite, it might sound weepy, it might sound nostalgic or wussy. I don't care. He was my hero, my dad. And my mum was just the person who held it all together. She was the glue that held the family together. I'd love them to be around today, to share a little bit of it with me.
This is about pride. This is about Birmingham, the city of Birmingham.
How would I sum up my 35 years? Manic, gone too quickly. It's been amazing. It's been a laugh a minute. I've met some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people. I've helped some people along the way as well, which has been fantastic for me. And I'm still the snotty-nosed kid from To the Back of 437 New John Street West. Because nothing will ever change that, you know. Nothing.
What's a good ball in as well. There's the header.
Yes!
Can he strike this one?
Can he strike this one?
Wow.
It's up the line! It's in!
Yes!
What a goal!
Confucius said, find a job you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And I've never worked a day in my life. Because I've found the best job in the world. Journey ain't over yet, by the way.
"35 Years of Tom Ross" starred, of course, Tom Ross. It was narrated by me, Jasper Carrot, and was produced by David Salt.